I didn't realize you'd taken out a second mortgage on your house. Props to your wife on that one. That's incredible. Well, thank God you succeeded.
I know, right? Yeah, it's nothing that I don't suggest that for everybody. It just kind of worked for us. And yeah, I'm thankful it worked out. And she was amazing through the process. She's a firm believer in, like, if you really feel led to do something, you've got to do it.
I'm Heidi Berkey.
And I'm Rachel Goble.
And this is the Ethical Storytelling Podcast. Gotta keep it fun.
Welcome to the Ethical Storytelling Podcast Storyteller Series. We're interviewing filmmakers, photographers, and writers in the NGO or impact space to learn how they apply or have failed at applying ethical storytelling in their work. Today I have the honor of talking with Benjamin Edwards, a photographer and filmmaker who documents weddings but describes his work with NGOs as his soul work.
I could have reached out in some way. I guess what it comes down to, Rachel, is I could have given instead of taken. I took an image of him. I took him at his lowest low. I took his dignity, and I justified it to try to fit the cause that I was there to try to fight.
We don't have all the answers, so join us in this conversation. Here we go. So you and I met in the context of some of your, like, development or nonprofit international work. So can you tell me a little bit about how you went from photography to also film production and photography for NGOs?
Absolutely. It's been based on relationships. Every organization that I've worked with, every trip that I've been on, has been a result of a relationship, of somebody recommending me, and that's how I got connected with the Freedom Story and the amazing work that you guys are doing was through a mutual friend who mentioned that might be fun to have me come along. And I think from a storytelling standpoint, kind of going from still photography, which I still do a lot of, it's just been a natural progression of storytelling for me, just the love of film. Like to take a powerful still image is amazing, but I just feel like it's amplified when you take those images and you start telling moving stories and you're adding music and these different elements and it becomes more of a team putting it together. Those are really powerful to me, and coupling it with organizations who are doing incredible work on the ground and they need to have their stories told. It's win-win for me. That's my soul work. I still photograph weddings, to pay bills and there's things that I love about weddings, but man, the soul work comes when I'm on the ground with people who every day are just giving their lives, for their fellow people and organizations. And that's what really keeps me going.
I love that you call it your soul work. Can you expand on that a little bit more? What is it about the work that makes it really come alive for you as a passion?
I'll never forget standing in a field in a village in Uganda. It was probably 2006, and really, Rachel, for the first time in my life, other than, you know, standing at the altar with my wife on our wedding day, it was really the first time that I had felt like I was in the right place. I was exactly where I was supposed to be at that moment. There was nowhere else in the world that I should have been other than standing there telling those stories. I'll never forget that. And every time I take a trip like that, as much work as it is to difficult to leave family and the business and the preparation, and I don't travel well physically, but once I'm there, it's exactly where I'm supposed to be. And so I call it my soul work because it's something that I look forward to. It's something that keeps me going. And I've learned so much about the world and other people and myself through those experiences.
Yeah. So what I think is so interesting about this series, which is our storyteller series, is it's at its core, I think, exploring the power dynamics that are present in the telling of stories. And so as you share, like that specific example, right, of you standing in this field and saying there's nowhere else that you'd rather be at that point in time. That same reality is that you are the outsider and you're coming into a culture and you're telling stories in this culture of a country and of a people that are not your own, right? And so mm-hmm. can you speak to that tension at all? Because I know that you've expressed that and you feel that and you recognize that. So how do you navigate that?
That's a great question, and in fact, I don't think I could navigate it if it were not for the people on the ground with us. That's something that we teach in our workshops that deal with, you know, telling stories for humanitarian organizations or nonprofits, is that it's so important to do it alongside the folks that live there. So that we're not coming in with our own ideas and concepts and forcing them and bending the story in that manner. It's got to come from a local indigenous standpoint. And that is difficult because the reality is a lot of our, the people who are going to see these stories are, you know, for the most part, Westerners. And mm-hmm. so it is difficult to bridge that gap of this is an ethical, accurate story from their standpoint, but yet we really need to communicate to these Westerners who haven't been on the ground. They haven't experienced this. So again, I think I go into it now more than I ever have. There's certainly been examples of times where I haven't navigated that well. And I just try to be mindful of utilizing the people who are on the ground who know best and always, always, always deferring to their better judgment.
So I love that you just shared that you haven't had times where you haven't navigated that well. Can you share one of those times and how that's continually shaped you? Because we all have those times, and I think it's incredibly important to talk about them, to name them, to own them. I'm sure that even 10 years from now, we're going to be looking back and having those same reflections of how we're acting now. So can you share one of those times with us?
Absolutely. And it is embarrassing because you look back and you think, oh, I should have known better. But I think the reality is we're all just trying to do the best that we can with what we have.
Sure.
The one time that really stands out to me, and I'm sure there's many others, but when it really clicked for me personally without really having somebody there to mentor me and tell me was in Nicaragua. I was photographing for an organization who was working in La Chureca, the dump there where, you know, many families lived inside and young girls were being trafficked just so that their parents could have access to better garbage. I mean, it's the lowest of the low. And we were in there in the dump storytelling for this organization, and I'll never forget walking into this, I guess you could call it a village. We went through a little gate, and we were there doing an interview, and I looked over, and there was a man laying in a puddle and just squirming and just it very clearly he had been drinking a lot and just kind of nearly passed out, but just moaning and laying in this puddle, and he was filthy. It was a very disturbing image, and mm-hmm. the locals there just say, oh, just ignore him, he's just, you know, he's a drunk or he's got issues or whatever. And for whatever reason, I took a photo of him in that position at that time and captured it. And, you know, there was no reason for it other than I think perhaps at that time I was following a lot of photojournalists in the media. And I think at that point, maybe I justified it by saying, hey, I'm just capturing the situation as it is here. You know, I was photographing children sifting, you know, through trying to find something to eat in the dump. And so this was just a part of that. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a moment there where I could have, instead of raising my camera, I could have walked over to see if he needed anything. I could have reached out in some way. I guess what it comes down to, Rachel, is I could have given instead of taken. I took an image of him. I took him at his lowest low. I took his dignity, and I justified it to try to fit the cause that I was there to try to fight. And it wasn't right away, but a few weeks afterward, I was going through and culling and looking at the images from that trip, and I was ashamed of myself. The photo served no purpose for the work that I was doing. And again, I don't know if it was just, hey, I'm trying to be, you know, photojournalist Ben, or, you know, take these captivating images to put on the blog or whatever it was. But I try to be so mindful of that now, and try to put myself in that position. What if that was me? What if that was my child? What if that was my dad or grandfather? And that's so critical.
So just to play devil's advocate here for a second, let's take today's Rohingya crisis, which for those of us that follow that, like, there's really disturbing images and stories and realities coming out of right now what I would consider to be one of the largest world atrocities that we're seeing today. And so kind of going back to this story that you share, I think that there's plenty activists and organizations that might argue that these images do need to get out, and that telling the story in a dignifying way also includes releasing these images of the incredibly harsh realities that people are facing. And so what would you say to them, or how might you guide them towards a more dignifying way of telling story for the long term, recognizing that these images might still be online 20 years from now?
Right. There are probably storytellers out there who have no issue gathering that type of media, that type of content. For me, just based on my travels and what I've seen and the people that I've spoken to, it is nearly impossible for me now not to put myself in their shoes. So when there are these crazy world events happening, when there is so much bad and it needs to be exposed so that good things can hopefully come, I need to have permission. I need to know that it's okay from these people, that the images that I'm taking, or the video, what I'm filming, they need to know my heart behind it. I'm not there just to grab and steal these images so that I can get a paycheck, or that my boss is going to be happy that I got, you know, a front page image, or that the organization is going to raise a ton of money because of this fly in the eye type of imagery. I need to know that there has to be an exchange there for me with these are people, these are souls. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the only difference between what's happening there and where we live is infrastructure. You tear our infrastructure away, and it could be a foreign journalist coming in taking photos of my children.
Yeah.
So for me personally, I need to have an exchange there where I know that they're okay with me making this content in hopes that it's going to better their situation, if at all possible.
So you mentioned permission. Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah.
So explain a little bit more what you mean when you say permission, and even if you have like a certain workflow that you go through when you're on the ground, what that looks like.
Well, I mean, it's different in every situation. A lot of times there's a language barrier, and that's why I think it's always important to have somebody on the ground who understands the culture and the language. But as far as workflow goes, with photography, we will try to have a photo release printed in the native language, and have somebody explain it to the person that we're photographing or filming, and they sign it if they can. If not, we can do a verbal release on video. If I'm just doing a strictly photographic workflow, that release is photographed and sits alongside those images when I'm culling. It never leaves. And I can put some of that in the meta tags, like the name of the person. And that's something that I feel strongly about that I'm trying to do better, is that if I post a picture, if we use a picture, like, there is a name there. This person has a name. They have a story, and it deserves to be told. So I'm trying to keep better track of just the person, their name and their story, mm-hmm. and where they live, and as much info of that as I can keep in the metadata of the image, the better. Mm-hmm. So I always try to keep those alongside, whether they're written or in video form.
So you've led something called, is it Workshops for Purpose? Workshops with Purpose?
Workshops with Purpose, yeah.
I can never remember. Okay. So I know you've been leading these Workshops with Purpose for quite a while. And can you just explain what they are? And then secondly, I'd love to hear kind of what your goal is and maybe some of the changes that you've seen in the individuals that have come on these trips.
Right. Yeah. So Workshops with Purpose was really born out of just being contacted by people saying, hey, we love what you're doing. Like, you know, photographers, like, we love what you're doing. Like, how do we do that? So my friends, Marianne and Andrew Nicodem and Kevin Kubota, another good friend of mine, we were all kind of being contacted by people because we were doing similar work. And the resounding, like, just like, hey, we want to know how to do this. And so we put together our first workshop in Kenya and asked storytellers, photographers to come along and, hey, would you be interested in paying for this workshop? And we'll show you how to go in and work with organizations in an ethical way, and how to create imagery on the ground that's dignifying to the people that you're telling stories for. And it was amazing. It was incredible. First of all, it was just encouraging to know that there are people out there who want to do this the right way. Mm. And of course, as time goes on, we're developing what that right way is, and we're continuing that conversation. But it was encouraging to know that people out there care enough to do this work and care enough to do it right. And so we told some amazing stories for a nonprofit hospital that was just, they're just doing incredible work in a difficult area. And it was so successful that we put on another one in Bolivia, working with Food for the Hungry. And then also partnered with an amazing organization called the Freedom Story in Thailand. So a lot of these photographers have gone on to work with other organizations, and I see them out doing this work, and I'm just super proud of them. Mm. And honored that they'd want to take the workshop and go out and do this work.
So when you come home from the field, yeah, what does your post-production process look like?
Well, a lot of coffee to start things off. Like, I am not a great traveler. So, like, when I come home, I know there are, like, so many ways to fight jet lag, but I just struggle. So, and it depends on the trip, too. Like, you know, there was a specific trip that I took to DRC, to the Congo, that, man, it messed me up for years. Mm. We were in a situation where we faced in one night what a lot of those people face every day. A rumor that the village we were in was going to be attacked that night, and it was going to happen. Like, there was really good intel on it. And we all just stayed up all night praying, and like 4 something in the morning, like, all hell breaks loose, gunfire, mortar, everything. And we thought like that was the end. And I didn't think I was going to see my family again. And, you know, it turned out to be that the UN was actually launching a counterstrike on this rebel group. And, you know, it turned out to be okay. But that put an element of fear in me that just held me hostage for years. Mm. So when I got home from that trip, I was a mess for 6 weeks.
Yeah. You know, you bring up a good point that I didn't even have my notes to touch on, but the idea of secondary trauma. And I think that this is something that people just aren't talking about in the storytelling very much. And you just shared a really specific and real example of what that looks like in your life. So now, how do you navigate that?
Right. That's a great question. And I think it's something that does need to be discussed more and more, because if this is something you're going to do and you're going to go tell stories, you're going to be faced with this. And I'll never forget, I was in a hotel room in Uganda, sharing a room with our good friend Ken Witzman, about women who had undergone FGM, female genital mutilation, and just unbelievable stories of how that has affected these young ladies' lives and just the trauma that they go through. And I'll just never forget. I just, I was trying to be strong. Like, my buddy Ken is next to me, and we're, going to sleep. And I had to raise the blanket over my face, and I just sobbed. I just could not hold in the weight that I had felt that day. And I sobbed for these women who, yes, they had a voice, but it wasn't being heard. Like, they needed the megaphone. And so we were there to be the megaphone, but the weight that that was dropped on us by hearing these stories was immense.
What is it like to be a man and to be telling the stories of vulnerable women?
What, could you say that again? I'm sorry.
Yeah, what is it like to be a man and to be telling these stories of vulnerable women?
That's a great question. I think, depending on the stories that are being told, I think it's important to have a woman there to make people feel more comfortable. I mean, a lot of the storytelling that I've done, Rachel, has been in these situations where it's like FGM or rape, and I think it's important to know what stories you're going to be telling so that the appropriate people can be there. But for me personally, it's difficult for me because I'm like a hugger. I love to just be there for people, and that's just where my heart is. But I can't, most of the time, it's just not acceptable for me to go up and hear
comfort
a terrible story of rape and go up and just want to hug, cry with a person. So it is difficult, on a lot of levels, being a guy, being out there doing that kind of work.
I think, too, having worked with you where you interviewed some of the women in our community in Thailand, I mean, that's part of why I wanted you on this podcast. I think that you just handle stories and people and sensitive topics, whether it's poverty or female genital mutilation. You wear your heart on your sleeve in a really safe way for people. And I've always appreciated your posturing and how you show up in communities. I think that there's a lot to learn from you in that. Along those lines, just as we start to wrap up, is there any advice that you want to leave for people, photographers, filmmakers, writers, or other storytellers that might be listening in, for ways that they can be bettering their craft towards ethical storytelling?
Yeah, that's a great question. And thank you for the kind words. I think what I'd kind of want to leave with is that a lot of times these organizations, because of funding, they will ask storytellers to come along, and you are on whirlwind poverty tour. It is okay, at 1 o'clock, we're going to hear this story. At 3 o'clock, we're going to go to this village. At 4 o'clock, we're going to be in this house, this village. And it's whirlwind. And I think for me, over time, that really weared on me. It's how do you go into these situations and hear these terrible stories and be like, well, thanks for sharing. Hey, we got to go. We got another house to go to. These are human beings that have experienced trauma in a way that most of us in the West have not experienced. And they're doing something that is not always a part of their culture, to share such a deep, intimate, traumatic thing. Mm-hmm. And so going into these situations, and again, I know that, you know, the organizations have to, they have to maximize the time of the storyteller. That's for the most part being a good steward of the funds that they were given to make it happen. And I understand that, but I think being conscious of, as a storyteller, going into these situations and really listening and making the person telling the story feel like they've been heard is extremely important. Mm. And so beyond all the, like, yeah, get pretty images and pretty film and like put a sick edit together and make it awesome, at the end of the day, we're talking about human beings. And so when you're on the ground, if it's a hand on the shoulder when it's appropriate, if it's holding a hand, if it's appropriate, if it's just making eye contact and letting the person know that they're amazing in whatever way you feel led at that time, do it. Like, make it human, make it relational. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the thing that's heavy on my heart.
Well, and earlier on in the conversation, you said two things that I'm hearing you repeat kind of throughout the whole conversation. And the first of those is that this is your soul work. And I think the heart of who you are is relational. And you bring that into every context that you walk into, regardless of where you are and the heaviness of those stories. And you also talked about you're not just there to take, but you're also there to give. And one of the really tangible ways in which I've seen you do that is simply by traveling with your little travel printer. And I know it's so nerdy, but you leave the images behind that you take with people. And I've gone back to these communities and these villages 3 or 4 years later, and those images are still hanging on their refrigerator or, you know, on the wall, and that matters to people. And so I think that concept of give and take that you're talking about, I think you execute the give really beautifully as much as you can in those contexts.
I think it's important for us when we go into these situations to always feel like we gave more than we take. Mm. And whether it's bringing a portable printer into the field so that we can leave behind an image of a mother and daughter, or, you know, whatever it may be, to be able to give something back. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, we're all like, it's all relational. We're all relational. We're all a part of this planet. And I think that that's just, it gets lost, I think, whether it's social media or distraction in one form or another. Like, at the end of the day, we need to remember we're all humans, we're all brothers and sisters, it's all relational. Mm-hmm. And we just need to get a little, you know?
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being so awesome and taking the time to share with us today. I think there were a lot of really good nuggets of wisdom that I'm going to walk away with for sure. So thanks for taking the time, friend.
It has been a pleasure and an honor. And let's go eat some bugs or something together, all right?
I do miss eating bugs with you.
I know, right?
Yeah.
You're my bug friend.
Soon enough. All right. Thanks so much, Ben. Hey, folks. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. You really should check out Benjamin's work at BenjaminEdwardsPhotography.com. When you're done with that, go check out EthicalStorytelling.com for more resources and to subscribe to our mailing list. And most of all, tell your friends about ethical storytelling. It's small and a labor of love. We all do this because we want to see change, so help us spread the word with your family and friends. Before we say goodbye, we want to say thank you to everyone that helped on the show this week. First, you all, the listeners, for tuning in. Lauren Ellis for web support. Music by Broke for Free, and Kyle Harrer for producing and editing each episode. Be sure to join us next week. All right, Kyle. I don't know how to stop it.